Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Tamara Keith. I cover Congress here at NPR.
Welcome to the podcast, Tamara.
Thank you.
Ken Rudin is, as we like to say, away. So, I think it's a terribly appropriate time, a disturbingly appropriate time to have you on the podcast this week, Tamara, because, well, you know, those people that you cover seem to be, well, doing some politics.
Oh, I believe this is approximately 100% politics. And about,
approximately, give or take 5 or 10.
Yeah, and approximately nearly 0% policy.
There you go. So that's an answer to the first question, I guess. Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, what it has looked like to you this week as the House Republicans have once again, shall we say, seized center stage.
It has been remarkable. On Saturday, when the bill passed in the Senate, this is a bill to extend the payroll tax holiday and unemployment benefits in the doc fix for 2 months, a stopgap because they couldn't come to agreement on something bigger. That thing passed overwhelmingly.
89-10.
That just doesn't happen.
No, I mean, 7 Republican opponents. I mean, I just can't think of anything that has Democrats on it where you only get 7 Republicans against it.
And I think that was a sign that the Republicans' leader, Mitch McConnell, came in and said, look, we've got a deal. This deal is done. Make this big. Let's go home.
And let's just stop and think about what everybody was talking about on Saturday when the Senate did this. They were all talking about how Obama had caved again. The big theme of this particular pre-holiday crunch was, there are the Democrats. First, they gave up on the millionaire surtax, and then they gave them the pipeline. They told the president, no, you can't have a year to push off this difficult decision on this pipeline, Keystone Pipeline, from Canada down to Louisiana with all that ugly, really needs to be refined oil in it. You're going to have to decide between labor unions and environmentalists right now. So that was a slap to the president, and that's what everybody was talking about on Saturday.
And the president took it and said, okay, this will be fine. We'll just get this done. We'll get through to the new year. We'll fight this fight again. And then Democrats were perfectly happy to fight that fight again because it's been working really well for President Obama in terms of polling.
The surtax on millionaires, not the Keystone.
No, but just talking about a payroll tax holiday, the president talking about a middle class tax cut over and over and over again has been really good for the president.
Is that possibly then what stuck in the craw of the House Republicans, that the president was going to get to do this again in February, that would be a time even closer to the election? And they just didn't want to have that happen. So they dug in their heels and thought that they would get more traction with the argument of, let's get our work done, let's bring the Senate back, let's get this done for the full year before the end of this year.
They are definitely making that argument. They are most certainly not admitting, at least not publicly, that they're doing this simply to take a later argument away from President Obama. They're not admitting that. They're just saying, certainty. It's all about certainty.
Certainty for the job creators.
Absolutely. I've heard that a few times before.
Yeah. Well, you are the in-house expert. This brings up a story that you did earlier this month about the job creators. And would it make a difference? Could we find some entrepreneurs out there who are going to either hire or not hire on the basis of whether or not, if they made $1 million profit in their small business, they were going to have to pay 2 or 3 percentage points of surtax on that in order to finance this whole payroll tax bill?
And I went to the places where I would think I would find them. I went to the Republican leaders in the House and the Senate. I went to the House Small Business Committee. I went to the National Federation of Independent Business, the Chamber of Commerce, other groups that have been saying a millionaire surtax would hurt us and would hurt hiring. And for whatever reason, they couldn't produce anyone.
They couldn't produce somebody to say, here's an example, somebody making $1 million a year in profit with a small business, or a medium-sized business, and either hiring or not hiring on the basis of exactly what his tax rate would be a year from now.
And the fact that they couldn't come up with anyone, it doesn't necessarily prove anything, but it's curious.
Now, I understand that one of the explanations that you heard was that people don't like to talk about their own taxes. They don't like to reveal how much money they may expect to make. They don't want to talk about the fact that they may be making $1 million in profit on their business in a given year.
Yes. And to bring it back to where we are right now.
Yes.
The millionaire surtax, not on the table.
Not on the table.
Not on the table at all.
Well, the White House gave up on it.
The White House gave up. Republicans won on that one. And then it seems as though House Republicans just wanted a little bit more.
Well, they got the Keystone.
They got the Keystone.
And then what was the next thing they wanted?
And the next thing they want is not to have this fight again in February. They want to have this fight right now, right in the height of the holiday season. And they said over and over again in the last couple of days, as House Republicans and the House as a whole returned to Washington, they said, we are willing to work through Christmas to get this done.
Which sounds a lot better than saying we want to reopen this deal and get more.
Yes.
You know, you talk to these guys all the time. How much of this is about the time frames and the politics, and how much of it reflects an actual distaste for the payroll tax cut extension itself on the part of at least some House Republicans?
The thing that was really baffling to me is sort of the reversal that's happened here among House Republicans. So President Obama in September rolls out his jobs plan. He says, I want to extend this payroll tax holiday for another year. And so I go running out to interview House Republicans and naively say things like, oh, so the president's proposing a tax cut. You should like that, right? And universally, everyone I talked to across the Republican spectrum, everyone I talked to said, oh, yeah, no, we don't really like that one.
Now, is it just because it was coming from Obama and they had decided that everything the president said in this package was going to be something that they needed to oppose?
No, I think that among Republicans, there is a sort of a special discomfort with a payroll tax cut. And partially that is because it is linked to Social Security. So you can't just starve government. You actually need to backfill that. So everyone I talked to was really uncomfortable with the idea of extending the payroll tax holiday for another year. And then something changed, and leadership in the House and the Senate, Republican leadership in the House and the Senate said, we're on board with this. This is going to happen. Now, you talk to rank and file House members, and still a lot of them are really uncomfortable with this. Some of them so much so that they will straight out say they don't think it should happen.
And this is part of the energy that drove the rebellion in the House. It's not over 12 months or 2 months so much. It's partly over real policy differences down underneath.
And the question that I have is, are Americans even paying attention at all? And if they are, how much of the detail of this is breaking through? Because I think quite possibly all that's breaking through is there was a deal. The House Republicans say there's not a deal now. Oh, and by the way, your taxes might go up.
Ah, that's the point where they start to pay attention. And that's the point where I suspect people start to ask, well, why? Why is that happening? Didn't I hear the president say he didn't want them to? Didn't I hear all the Republicans say they didn't want them to? Aren't Republicans against all tax increases? What's going on here? How come these people can't get together? Is it really about whether it's 60 days or 12 months? Is that really what we're disagreeing about here?
And in comes the Wall Street Journal editorial. It was rough.
It was a shocking editorial, I thought, because while I could imagine somebody writing exactly what was written there, I could not imagine that going into the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which is normally highly supportive of all the positions of the congressional Republican majority in the House and the Republican minority in the Senate. Generally speaking, while they don't love everything those guys do by any means, they see more of their philosophy expressed there than they do in the Democrats, for sure.
And I think part of the problem that House Republicans face on this is that it's a very complicated argument that they're making. They came back and they said they didn't like the Senate bill, in part because it was just a two-month extension. Another thing they don't like, actually, is that it continues the extended unemployment benefits as is. And House Republicans actually want to reform, it would be the word that they would use. They want to reform the unemployment system in a way that would actually dramatically cut benefits for the long-term unemployed and require peeing in a cup and various other reforms.
Which is popular with a lot of people. A lot of people feel
Absolutely.
As though jobless benefits become some sort of permanent welfare, and that the folks who have gone jobless for this extended period of time have to bear more responsibility for that themselves. And let's try to wrap up this question about the Hill if we possibly can. Is there any chance the Senate will come back or send back conferees to do what the House is telling them they want done?
It seems unlikely. What Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is saying is that he has no intention of bringing his members back. He also has no intention of appointing conferees. And the reality is they can't even appoint conferees until the Senate comes back,
right,
and would have to take several votes, or you'd need unanimous consent, and there's no way they're getting unanimous consent. So I'm not sure how this ends.
People say, who's going to blink first? My question is, how does one blink at this point? If John Boehner were to come out and say, all right, I give up. I'm going to bring all my peeps back, and we're going to have a vote here and approve what the Senate did, and we'll just slink off. I'm not sure he could get the votes to make that stick. I'm not sure he could get the votes to prevail in the House.
Democrats in the House aren't so sure about that. Democrats in the House really, really want a vote on this.
So they think they could pull over enough Republicans if there were a revote or if they had a straight up or down vote on the Senate plan.
Well, that's what they kept saying all along. Partially, though, I think they may just want to get House Republicans on the record voting for a tax increase. I think that they would enjoy that. And the reality is that House Republicans had said they were going to take a straight up or down vote on this payroll tax measure and then switched it up and said,
Can't do that.
Let's not do that. Let's instead do this crazy procedural thing that it seems sort of uncommon in the way it was structured, in which we will vote to reject a bill and create a conference committee all in the same vote.
And this is part of the reason, perhaps, that at least among high information voters, Gallup is finding that the Congress is at an all-time low in its respect from the voters.
11%, the lowest it's been since they started asking the question. Other polls have put it at 9%, but it is very clear that if someone doesn't blink, come January 1st, 160 million people are going to have just a little bit less money in every paycheck, and 1.8 million people in January alone would lose unemployment benefits.
And then more each month as we roll along.
And that is going to cause a lot of pressure. Nothing focuses the mind like 160 million angry Americans.
Or at least dissatisfied or disgruntled. And my guess here is that they're going to want to come back earlier than the usual late January return from the holidays, which usually stretch out several weeks. And they're going to want to try to, number one, blame each other. We'll hear that until they get back to town.
Oh, they've been doing that already.
And then number two, they will try to cobble something together that, well, makes everyone look less bad.
I have a sneaking suspicion, though, that there could be some sort of thing that happens, some Deus Ex Machina or whatever it is that
comes in
and swoops down and sometime between Christmas and New Year makes this all go away.
Let's hope you're right.
I hope I'm right, only in that it would be really nice to have a little breather before it all starts again in January.
I agree, except that we won't get much of a break, though, because we still have to talk about Iowa. Iowa is going to hold their caucuses on January 3rd, a Tuesday night. This is a first in Iowa. They've been on Monday. They've been on Thursday. Now they're going to be on the night after all the bowl games, and they're asking Republicans to go out, and Democrats, too. They don't have much choice. But on the Republican side, you have this broad shelf of political product, and they're all smiling away, and you've got about 5 or 6 people here who have a chance to be in double digits, and maybe nobody will be much over 20%. It's a really fractured field.
And they are really beating each other up now. This has gone from, let's all stand on stage in these debates and, you know, throw a few little tiny barbs, but we're mostly friendly because we really all just hate Barack Obama, to, oh my gosh, they are beating each other up.
I think, you know, the turning point came, I would guess, when Herman Cain went down, when we lost Herman Cain from the scene. And we had previously had spikes for Michelle Bachmann. Then that went away. We had a huge spike for Rick Perry. He looked like he was going to sweep everyone else away. And then he had his problems in the debates. There was the immigration issue. There was the long pause, the oops. He disappears. Then we get a Herman Cain spike. Then he goes down because of the sexual allegations. And
Libya.
And his also poor performance on certain questions in certain editorial board meetings, which happened to be on videotape on everybody's computer in the entire world.
And watched over and over and over again, especially in Iowa.
And then we get perhaps the most surprising spike of all. This guy who everybody had known about for many, many, many years, or so we thought. Somebody who, when he initially got in, his campaign completely collapsed almost overnight, and much of his staff resigned, and he couldn't raise any money. He went off on a trip to the Greek islands, and nobody was taking him seriously. Suddenly, based on some strong debate performances and the collapse of these other candidates, it's all about Newt Gingrich for about 2 weeks.
For about 2 weeks.
Now, he's apparently taken a little walk off the table, and he's dropping like a rock. Most of those negative ads you're talking about are directed at him. And it seems to me that when Kane went away and everybody started focusing on Gingrich, that's when it got nasty.
Would you believe that Herman Cain became the flavor of the month and Newt Gingrich was only the flavor of a few weeks? Is that possible?
Yeah, I think a fortnight.
The flavor of the fortnight?
All of this, I think, in the end, and when Ken and I have talked about this on the podcast, we usually come down to very reluctantly saying, I guess we still think it's going to be Mitt. Not because the party's going to fall in love with him, but because they'll eventually just shrug their shoulders and say, here's the guy with the best chance against Obama, and even though we might have liked somebody else better, they blew themselves up, or they proved to be, in some sense or another, too vulnerable to attack.
Is it possible that Newt Gingrich is the boyfriend that pulls up on a motorcycle and is fun and exciting, and Mitt Romney is the man you marry?
Yeah, driving a Ford. Well, my guess is that Newt Gingrich would not cut much of a figure on a motorcycle. But let's just assume that he fulfills that same sort of Rolling Stones kind of role in the teenage girl of the Iowa Republicans' lives. Interesting, though, that the Iowa Republicans have been characterized, particularly since 2008, as being particularly interested in the social issues. Actually, this goes back further. The 2000 Iowa caucuses and so on, there seemed to be a very strong emphasis on what some of us would call moral issues, you know, the abortion issue, the gay marriage issue, prayer in the schools.
Well, then that would tend to favor Rick Santorum.
Now, you've had some chance probably to watch Rick Santorum over the years, even though he hasn't been in Congress recently. You know, what's his profile in this race? He hasn't really been one of the front runners.
But he is Mr. Family Values. He talks about his children. If you are a conservative, evangelical Iowa voter, then he says everything right.
It's interesting, even though he is a Catholic himself and a very devout Catholic, he has probably views on the issues that are closer to the evangelical Protestant Iowa voters that we've been talking about. There's a group called the Family Leader. Their leader is a guy named Bob Vanderplatz, and he's been auditioning the candidates all year long, getting an enormous amount of media attention for it. And this week, the Family Leader had their big announcement and announced they weren't going to make an announcement because they weren't going to endorse anybody. They couldn't get happy with any of the candidates enough as a group. But Bob Vanderplatz said, I kind of like Rick Santorum.
So what does this mean?
In the end, I think it probably means that the Family Leader was overinterpreted as a group that was really going to have some big unifying power to bring the evangelical vote to any one particular candidate. I would guess that Vanderplatz alone doesn't deliver all the evangelical votes in Iowa by a long stretch.
So there's no Mike Huckabee this time around?
Not like in 2008, no. He was an evangelical minister from nearby Arkansas, you know, a Baptist, and an enormously charming guy who had been in the state for almost full-time for a long period of time, and he really just won people over. There was no one else who was contesting that vote as effectively as he did in 2008. This time around, you've got not only Santorum, you've got Michelle Bachmann, who is from neighboring Minnesota, was born in Iowa, has really pitched hard to the evangelical voter, and then you've got Rick Perry, who's really at this point trying to base his campaign almost entirely, it seems, on religion. That should have some appeal, at least, to people who are going to come out on a cold Tuesday night and argue with their neighbors and want to represent from the standpoint of their values and their voting records.
I want to talk about another passionate group of voters, and those would be the Ron Paul people.
This could be this year's Iowa story.
It's starting to look that way, but who knows? You know, things change. But right now, Ron Paul is rising.
He is rising. He's the guy who's benefited in the polls as Newt Gingrich has slid. And he is also the guy who consolidates to some degree that vote in Iowa that doesn't see itself as voting on Sunday morning when they're in church. This is a group of Iowa Republicans who would just as soon be choosing on other issues, primarily perhaps fiscal issues. You know, Ron Paul's the guy who thinks we should eliminate 80% of the federal government and get rid of the Federal Reserve and change the whole way we do the banking system. And also, and this is particularly true among younger voters, people who identify with his rather isolationist views of foreign policy. We ought to get out of the world. We ought to bring our troops home from not just the Middle East, but Europe and Japan. And let's just stop being the world's policeman and stop spending half the money the whole world spends on arms.
And he has a ground game. The question that we've been asking a lot about Iowa this year is, does the ground game matter? Does having people in every county willing to go to the caucuses and stand up for you, does that matter? Or can you run a campaign where you spend a lot of time on television and don't visit the state that much?
Mitt Romney,
Newt Gingrich, Herman Cain before him. And it seems as though Ron Paul is gaining in the polls and could actually deliver on that come caucus day.
That's right. Ron Paul has enough money to run ads. He's run some enormously effective killer ads against Gingrich.
Super entertaining, too.
And really well done. And there's that in combination with his ground game and then that fanatical loyalty that he's always had on part of his supporters. That's what you really need to get out there on a cold January night. So he seems to have the trifecta, the air war, the ground game, and the fanatical loyalty. Right now, I'd put my money on Ron Paul, but I don't see him going very far up into the 20s percentage-wise. I see a lot of people bunched between 10 and about 25. So if Ron Paul wins Iowa, I think it's good news for Mitt Romney. I think it's very bad news for Newt Gingrich. And that probably means that we take another long step towards the inevitability of Mitt Romney. That's why Romney's fine with not winning Iowa. He's just concentrated on winning New Hampshire, doing well enough in South Carolina, and then winning in Florida. That's the ticket for him.
I think that Mitt Romney's strategy all along has been to just sort of plod along and not necessarily be the top guy all the time. And he has the money and he has the belief in himself and he has the campaign infrastructure to wait this out, to let some people be the flavor of Iowa and the flavor of New Hampshire, possibly, though probably not. He can wait this out. And he's on the ballot in every state, right?
I believe he will be. And that's more than we can say for Newt Gingrich, who's not gotten on the ballot in every state because his ground game has just really gotten going in the last couple of months.
And Newt Gingrich is in Virginia this week, in fact, holding rallies right before Iowa because he needs to gather more signatures to try to get on the ballot in Virginia.
Which could be seen as kind of doing your campaign backwards.
Or kind of doing things the Newt way.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Tamara Keith.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
But what I really want to know is, are you going to go my way?